Let's talk about the Ten Commandments and the Ten Commandments as the moral foundation of law, because you'll find there are a lot of people today who don't even know what role they play in a legal system. A good friend of mine is a retired professor of education out at the University of Northern Colorado, and some years ago he was conducting a survey. He went to a suburban high school near Denver and went to a class of seniors and, oh, okay. I wonder if that may be out of battery. There it is. Okay. Anyway, his survey was to find out what these high school seniors knew about the Ten Commandments. And he said that he was kind of surprised to find that there were a fair number of them that couldn't name a single one. And most of them could name two or three. There were a few who could name all of them. But most of them, or there were some that couldn't name a single one. Well, then 10 years later, he went back to the same high school and conducted a survey in the same class. Obviously, it's different kids this time, but the same class. And he found that there had been a change. In the later survey, he found that a fair number of kids would be saying, I don't know what you're talking about, never heard of them. Earlier, kids might say, I don't know any of them, but nobody would say, I haven't heard that there are such a thing. But kids are saying later, I don't know what you're talking about. I've never heard of anything called Ten Commandments. Well, it kind of reminds me of the days of King Josiah. And you recall that somewhere around 630 B.C. that Josiah, an eight-year-old boy, became king. His father, Amon, and his grandfather, Manasseh, had been apostate kings and had done a lot to ruin Israel, or Judea, I should say. But Josiah wanted to restore the worship of God, and he led a revival in Judea this time. And as they were renovating the temple, probably under several inches of dust in the back archives, somebody found a scroll. And they took that scroll to the priest. The priest took it to the high priest. They dusted it off and discovered that it was the law of Moses. And they took this scroll of the law of Moses to King Josiah, who is a young adult by this time. He reads it, and he is smotes his breast and tears his garments in a gesture of repentance. He says, great is the wrath of the Lord upon us because we have not followed these commandments. Now, what I find so interesting here is there is such consternation in Judea this time over the discovery of the law of Moses in the temple in Jerusalem. You would think that the temple would be full of scrolls of the law of Moses. You would think that every Jewish bookstore on every corner in Jerusalem would have copies for sale. But here is a king who is seeking to go back to the worship of the God of David, his father, who didn't even know the law of Moses exists. That shows us how quickly, in the course of a generation or so, a Christian heritage can not only be wiped out of public places, but almost wiped out even from memory. And how important it is today, then, that we preserve and restore the memory of the heritage of this nation. So what I'd like to do now is talk about the foundational role of the Ten Commandments in our understanding of law. Some of you may recall that back in 1956, Cecil B. DeMille produced this movie, The Ten Commandments. And I think probably for a lot of us, we still think that Moses probably looked a lot like Charlton Heston. But if you go to the original uncut version of this movie, it begins with Cecil D. DeMille stepping out on the front, right there on screen, wearing a business suit, with an introduction. And here's what he says in his introduction. He says, ladies and gentlemen, young and old, this may seem an unusual procedure, but we have an unusual subject. The birth of freedom. The story of Moses. The theme of this picture is whether men ought to be ruled by God's laws or whether they are to be ruled by the whims of a dictator like Rameses. Are men the property of the state, or are they free souls under God? This same battle continues throughout the world today. That's DeMille in 1956. I think, and I have no idea what his religious beliefs were, but I think he showed an understanding of the role of the Ten Commandments as the moral foundation of law that probably most pastors, most lawyers, and most judges would not understand today. I think one of the things we need to understand is that God is the author of two kingdoms, church and state. He has established both. Each has its own role for the governance of man. The role of the state is to prevent the outward exercise of sin, to preserve our rights and make sure that people don't violate each other's rights. The role of the church is to lead people to Christ and to teach them in the principles of God's Word. And the Word, including the law, has an application to both. Luther made the statement that the Decalogue is not of Moses, nor did God give it to him first. On the contrary, the Decalogue belongs to the whole world. It was written and engraved in the minds of all human beings from the beginning of the Word. And he went on to say, natural law is the Ten Commandments. It is written on the heart of every human being by creation. It was clearly and comprehensively put on Mount Sinai, far better than any philosopher has stated. Natural law, then, is created and written in the heart. It does not come from man, but is a God-created law to which everyone who hears it must consent. Now, when we look to the Ten Commandments, we find that they are a summary of the law as we see it, the Jewish law of the Old Testament as a whole, those roughly 610 commandments as the Jews separated them, that the Ten Commandments take them and summarize them. Sometimes they are divided into two tables, and these tables would be, first of all, the one table of the law consisting of the commands, thou shalt have no other God before me, and thou shalt have no graven image, and remember the Sabbath and keep it holy, and these commands, the command about taking the name, Lord's name in vain, that's the first table. The second table of the law is the table that has the horizontal commands, those that relate to our dealings with other people. Thou shalt not kill, thou shalt not commit adultery, thou shalt not steal, thou shalt not bear false witness, thou shalt not covet, and the like. And that this deals with our relation to other people. Now, just as the Ten Commandments summarize the Mosaic Law as a whole, so you can say there are two commandments that summarize the Ten Commandments. And you may recall that there was a lawyer who went to ask Jesus a question, what is the greatest commandment? And the answer Jesus gave was an answer comparable to what the Jews of the time had given. They had divided these commandments into some 600-plus commandments. They had rated each of them in order of importance. And Jesus said, of course, that the first commandment is, thou shalt love the Lord thy God with all thy heart and with all thy soul and with all thy might. That commandment, which is found, of course, in Deuteronomy, is simply a summary of the first table of the law. And then he said, and the second is like unto it. Thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself. And that's found in Leviticus. And that is a summary of the second table of the law. And so you see, those two summarize the Ten Commandments. The Ten Commandments summarize the moral law as a whole. Well, the Ten Commandments over history have had a major role in the development of law. And Sir William Blackstone cites them extensively when he talks about the laws of nature, the revealed law, the doctrines that are revealed that he calls the revealed law that are found only in the Holy Scripture. And as we look to the continent of that time, we find that Constantine uses the Ten Commandments a great deal in his laws. Theodosian does the same. The Justinian Code does the same. So does Charlemagne. So does Maimonides. And we already mentioned Alfred the Great in England. Now, when the colonists came to this country in the early 1600s, in the northern colonies particularly, they not only follow the common law, but they even depart a little from the common law in order to make it more directly consistent with the Word of God. When Massachusetts develops a legal code in 1636, the pastor who has been commissioned to draft that code, a pastor by the name of Nathaniel Ward, he'd also had some legal training, the commission that the general court, which is really like a general assembly, had given him, was that he was to make this law agreeable to the laws of God. And he did so, and in many cases, citing directly from the Old Testament law in the process. In the southern colonies, Virginia in particular, we find that, again, their legal codes very much resembled those of New England, or maybe it'd be the other way around because the Virginia ones were first. And you have the laws moral, martial, and divine that Lord Delaware presents in 1611 when he takes over the Jamestown colony to save it from probable extinction. Every one of the Ten Commandments is in that code, with the exception of the command on graven images, and for some reason, apparently, they just didn't think that was going to be an issue. But we can see the role the Ten Commandments play, and what I'd like to demonstrate now is the role they play in American courts today. I began to explore this back when I was working with Chief Justice Moore and helping to draft some of his legal briefs in his case there, and here's something I find very interesting in the way the trial took place. You had the monument of the Ten Commandments that was in the judicial building of the state of Alabama. It had been placed there at no expense to the state at all. The trial took place a few blocks away over in the federal building. Now, in front of the federal building, there was a large sculpture erected at government expense of the Greek goddess Themis, the goddess of justice. Now, why is it unconstitutional to have the Ten Commandments in the Alabama Judicial Building, but it's all right to have a pagan goddess in front of the federal building? It's kind of like, choose you this day whom you will serve. And that question, we raise that in the briefs. Every court to consider it wouldn't even address that issue. Well, as I was looking at this, I thought it'd be very interesting to see how the courts quote the Ten Commandments. And my thesis was that if it is okay for courts to cite the Ten Commandments in court documents, then it ought to be okay for courts to place them on the wall or in the rotunda as well. In law, we use a couple of computer programs. One is called Westlaw, one is called Lexis, and that's spelled with an IS, not a US, but at any rate, these are computer programs that you can use to punch in words, and it will bring up cases where that term has been used. And so I decided several years ago that I would do a legal study on a computer search to see about the Ten Commandments. And what I put in was, first of all, the term Ten Commandments, and then the term Decalogue, and then I worded each commandment, wrote it out, each individually. All told, I found well over 1,000 cases in which courts of record have cited the Ten Commandments. And when I say courts of record, that means state supreme courts or federal courts, federal district circuit or the U.S. Supreme Court itself. And when we look to the way these commandments are used, I think they will demonstrate to us just how the Ten Commandments really do form the moral foundation of law. And so I'm going to look at these individually, and let's begin with the command. I'm going to try to take these in a logical order, necessarily as they are given. Thou shalt not take the name of the Lord thy God in vain. Now, what does that prohibit? When we ask that, the answer that immediately comes to mind, well, it prohibits cussing. It does, but it's much broader than that. This command, as Luther interpreted in his catechism as Calvin says in his Institutes, as the Catechism of the Catholic Church says, prohibits all speech that takes God's word lightly or puts God and his word in disrepute. One of these, certainly, is perjury. In other words, taking the name of the Lord thy God in vain includes perjury. Now, false witness would also apply to perjury, but this command applies to perjury as well. And this is essential to running a legal system properly. Already talked about Plato and Aristotle, seen how truth and justice are impossible without getting at the facts, finding out what is the truth. Did the defendant commit the crime or didn't he? Now, in order to get people to tell the truth in court, which we have to do if the court is going to be able to get at the truth, we employ oaths. We require people to say, I do swear that I will obey, that I will tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. So help me God. And by taking that oath, people are saying before God that I will tell the truth. George Washington, in that famous farewell address of 1797, asked this question, where is the security for property, for reputation, for life, if the sense of religious obligation desert the oaths, which are the instruments of investigation in courts of justice? A lot of people don't realize today that in the early days of the American Republic, an atheist was not allowed to testify in court because it was thought that if he didn't believe that there is a God in heaven, a God who knows all and sees all, and a God who you're not going to fool, even if you can fool the judge and the jury and everybody else, and a God before who someday you are going to have to stand and give account, if you don't believe that, you can't be counted on to tell the truth. In other words, the command, thou shalt not take the name of the Lord thy God in vain, is an instrumental command for getting at justice and doing justice in our courts. There's another interesting command here. Remember the Sabbath and keep it holy. And I'd like to talk about that command a little bit here because I don't think a lot of us realize how important this command really is. It is the only command of the Ten Commandments that is not reiterated in the New Testament, but there is some value to this command. And how it applies in the New Testament dispensation, I'm still thinking about that. I'm still not sure exactly, but Daniel Webster once said, the longer I live, the more highly do I esteem the Christian Sabbath, and the more grateful do I feel to those who impress its importance on the community. Ralph Waldo Emerson, who I disagree with on a lot of things, but Ralph Waldo Emerson said that the Sunday is the core of our civilization. Dedicated to thought and reverence, it invites to the noblest solitude and the noblest society. Blackstone put it like this, for besides the notorious indecency and scandal of permitting any secular business to be publicly transacted on that day in a country professing Christianity, and the corruption of morals which usually follows its profanation, the keeping one day in the seven as holy as a time of relaxation and refreshment, as well as for public worship, is of admirable service to a state considered merely as a civil institution. It humanizes, by the help of conversation and society, the manners of the lower classes, which would otherwise degenerate into a sordid ferocity and savage selfishness of spirit. It enables the industrious workman to pursue his occupation in the ensuing week, in health and cheerfulness. It imprints on the minds of the people their sense of their duty to God, so necessary to make them good citizens, but which yet would be worn out and defaced by an unremitted continuance of labor without any stated times of recalling them to the worship of their Maker. Well, there was an interesting case that took place. It was in Georgia back in the 1920s, and Georgia had a law that made Sunday the Sabbath, and we could get into a lot of issues as to whether the Sabbath should be celebrated at all today, whether it even applies, whether it's just a day of rest, or whether it's a day of worship, or both, and even which day it is, Saturday or Sunday. But this law made Sunday the Sabbath, which has been the Christian custom, but it contained an exception. The exception was except for works of mercy and necessity. And, of course, Jesus talks about this, about healing on the Sabbath, about gathering food on the Sabbath, things like this. But the law there said this, and there was a man who was charged with violating the Sabbath law because he ran a gas station, and he had the gas station open on Sunday. And his argument to the court was that a gas station is a work of necessity. Because if people have to travel on the Sabbath today, they need gas to travel. And so somebody has to be available to provide it for them. Well, the Georgia Supreme Court looked at that case, and in Williams versus State in 1928, the Georgia Supreme Court said, "We are of the opinion that under the application of even ancient rules, the sale of gasoline to a traveler on the Sabbath day who intends to continue his journey and for whom it is impossible to proceed without gasoline must be a work of necessity. Even under the strictness of the Mosaic law, travel on," he says Sunday, I think he should have said Saturday there, "was not prohibited, though a limit was prescribed for a Sabbath day's journey, and a Sabbath day's journey was not restricted in its purposes to worship or charity." So in other words, a gas station then was a work of necessity and therefore exempted from the Sabbath laws, but in reaching that conclusion, the Supreme Court of Georgia went back to the Mosaic law in order to reach that conclusion. Consider the command, "Honor thy father and thy mother." Delegated authority, in fact, John Locke says that all authority of human government ultimately stems from this commandment, because it is the authority that parents possess over their children that they delegate to the social compact to government. But it's interesting the way the courts have looked at this particular command to honor thy father and thy mother. And I'm going to give you a couple of interesting cases. One of these is Equity Investments versus Paris. This is a New York Supreme Court case from the year 1981. In this case, there was a woman who had rented an apartment, two-bedroom apartment, and she moved her elderly parents into the other bedroom, apparently in violation of the lease, and apparently also in violation of the rent laws of the state of New York, or the city of New York. She was prosecuted, and here's how the court reasoned it. The court said, "This case is an interesting dilemma of a conflict between two laws, one written in stone approximately 3,500 years ago, and the other written by mere mortals in 1962. The former is the fifth of the Ten Commandments given to Moses on Mount Sinai." And by the way, there are different ways of numbering the Ten Commandments, and I wish judges would refer to them by what they are rather than the number, because you have the Jewish numbering system, you have the Catholic numbering tradition that many Lutherans follow as well, and then you have the numbering system that most Protestants use. But he goes on to say, "And the latter is a subdivision of Section 652 of the New York City Rent and Eviction Regulations." Now, the prosecutor apparently had argued that the Mosaic Law of the Ten Commandments was not part of the law of the city of New York. But the judge said, "If we had eyes to see the subtle elements of thought which constitute the great substance of our present habit, both as regards the sphere of private life and as regards the action of the state, we would easily discover how very much we owe to the Jews for the Ten Commandments and other contributions to Western law." And then he concluded, The public policy of this state as expressed by statute and decisional law is not in conflict with the fifth of the Ten Commandments. It is all too rare in these troublesome times of self-indulgence to find people willing to sacrifice their own comfort and serenity for the sake of their parents. Therefore, far be it from the courts to punish such devotion. I'll give you a similar case. 1952, Federal District Court, Ryman versus Atchison. In this case, you had a woman who had immigrated to the United States from Canada. She had established American citizenship, but then she had to go back to Canada to spend an extended time caring for her ill mother, and the Immigration and Naturalization Service sought to revoke her citizenship because of that extended stay back in Canada. Well, here is what the Federal District Court said. The sole and only reason for plaintiffs going to Canada was, as before stated, the condition of her mother. To have failed her mother at this time would have been in violation of all the instincts of loyalty of a child for its parent, and contrary to the fifth commandment, to honor thy father and thy mother, that thy days may be long upon the land which the Lord thy God giveth thee, Exodus 20:12. The plaintiff performed her God-commanded duty to her mother, with the result that certain United States agents are now attempting to forfeit her citizenship in this country. Should such a dutiful daughter be deprived of the priceless possession of her American citizenship for doing nothing other than her filial duty? I think not. And in view of all the facts and circumstances in this case, I hold that plaintiff's stay in Canada was in legal effect involuntary, and as such, it could not be a ground for forfeiture of her nationality and citizenship in the United States of America. Well, you can see how the courts have used the command concerning honor thy father and thy mother as a basis to buttress the laws of this country in this area. Thou shalt not kill. I don't think I need to go into detail on all of that, of course, but our homicide statutes are based on this. The law involves moral judgments, as we've seen before. It involves imposing moral judgments by criminal statutes. But what about the command, thou shalt not commit adultery? A command that was law in all 50 states until not too long ago and still is illegal in many states, although with the Lawrence versus Texas decision where the Supreme Court, reversing previous cases, ruled that there is a constitutional right to engage in homosexual sodomy. And if the court is going to say there is a right to engage in homosexual sodomy, I'm not sure how they're going to justify prohibiting adultery or polygamy or many other things in the near future. But I'll give you an interesting case here involving adultery. And this involves a public official in the state of West Virginia who was convicted of having solicited a prostitute, and the state of West Virginia fired him from his position because of that conviction, based upon a state law that said that any public employee may be terminated for committing an offense of moral turpitude. Well, he argued that adultery is not an offense of moral turpitude. But I think he's wrong. We can certainly see the effect that it has on people. It leads to breakup of families, leads to trauma, resentment, uncertainty of parenthood, abandonment of children, non-support of children, sometimes violence. Here is what the West Virginia Supreme Court said in the case of Moore versus Strickling. I often like to tell Judge Moore that, remember the name of that case, Moore versus Strickling, in the year 1899. And in this case, the court upheld the firing of this public official, saying this was an act of moral turpitude because it is prohibited by the Ten Commandments. And looks into the court's language. These commandments in themselves, these commandments, which like a collection of diamonds, bear testimony to their own intrinsic worth, in themselves appeal to us as coming from a superhuman or divine source, and no conscientious or reasonable man has yet been able to find a flaw in them. Absolutely flawless, negative in terms but positive in meaning, They easily stand at the head of our whole moral system, and no nation or people can long continue a happy existence in open violation of them. Well, we can go on to thou shalt not steal, and the implications here are very obvious in regard to our basic laws concerning property rights and our various forms of theft laws, whether we're talking about outright stealing or stealing by force, meaning robbery or burglary or extortion or blackmail or fraud or various other forms. But on several occasions, the court has looked to this commandment to justify and even to explain what the meaning of the theft laws really are. One case, Fountain versus Florida, 1928. Florida Supreme Court said, in regard to what the word steal means as used in its Florida statute, the word steal may not be technically synonymous with the words to commit larceny, but it nevertheless is a very strong and significant word and commonly accepted meaning of the word, and it is very well defined by the standard dictionary as followed. To steal is to commit larceny. The eighth commandment of the Decalogue merely reads, thou shalt not steal. Yet was it ever doubted that it prohibited larceny of all kinds? In another case, this time a federal district court case in 1991, the court said concerning copyright infringements. In other words, plagiarism of somebody else's work. Copyright infringement violates not only the seventh commandment, but also the copyright laws of this country. Another case, 1931, the New York courts held that even in the present state of the law, the piracy of styles, is it not entirely outside the pale of the Eighth Amendment? Okay, so we see the moral basis here under the Ten Commandments for our larceny laws. How about the command, thou shalt not bear false witness against thy neighbor? Well, we've already seen the importance of this as far as testifying in court, but we see the importance of it elsewhere as well. And in society as a whole, we don't make it a crime to tell a lie. But we do make it a crime to give false information to a police officer, even if it's not under oath. We make it a matter of fraud to engage in making false statements that other people rely upon to their detriment. But the main thing about the command, thou shalt not bear false witness, is that it is essential to civilized life. We couldn't function as a civilization if people didn't tell the truth most of the time. If I'm on my way over here and I need to stop at a gas station and ask directions, why should I bother to ask a gas station attendant where the Sugar Land Bible Church is if he's just as likely to lie as tell the truth? Why should I ask anybody what time it is if I don't think that most of the time, at least, they're going to tell the truth? Communication becomes impossible without a presumption that most people tell the truth most of the time. And so there certainly is a civil basis for the command, thou shalt not bear false witness against thy neighbor. Now, what about the command, thou shalt not covet? It's interesting, we don't find anywhere in Scripture where anybody is actually punished by civil government for coveting. We see that this has been made part of the laws of King Alfred. We see that it's been made part of the laws in New England and in Virginia. But even there, we don't see anybody actually punished for having coveted. But while this law is probably not an appropriate subject of criminal punishment, it bears a very strong relationship to our legal system. You might say it's kind of like a hedge. It's a hedge against immoral and destructive conduct. The person who covets his neighbor's property is more likely to steal. The person who covets his neighbor's wife is more likely to commit adultery. People who have been taught not to covet are more likely to be good citizens than those who have not been so taught. And there's a misapplication of what the term coveting means, And once somebody wrote a letter to the Montgomery paper in which they said that without the command of coveting, the whole free enterprise system could not exist because free enterprise is based upon coveting. Well, that person, I think, misunderstood what coveting is all about. Coveting does not mean wanting something and being willing to work and save and buy it. As the church traditionally has defined coveting, it has four meanings. First, wanting what God does not want you to have. Second, wanting something obsessively. Third, wanting something so badly that you're willing to use illegal or unethical means to get it. Or fourth, wanting something so badly that you resent the fact that other people have it. I remember in my early days in the Air Force, I had a friend who was a lieutenant colonel. I was a captain at that time. And he had a Cadillac. And he was quite strongly conservative in his thinking. And we would go out to lunch occasionally. And one time he picked me up and I commented on what a nice car he was. And he said, you know, attitudes have changed about that. He said, I grew up in a poor Italian neighborhood. We were working class people. We couldn't afford a Cadillac. But we'd be standing out there in the street, and we'd see somebody drive by in a Cadillac, and we'd say, boy, that's a nice car, and I'm going to work hard and get my education and save my money, and someday I'm going to be driving a Cadillac. Well, he said, that's exactly what I did, and now I have one. But the attitude has changed. Now people's attitude is, I can't afford a Cadillac. Why should he be allowed to drive one? What has come in is the Marxist spirit of class resentment. And that's what real coveting is all about. Resenting the fact that other people have something that you don't have and wanting to pull them down to your level. Okay, we've talked about coveting. Let's see what we have missed here. Well, what about these commandments? I am the Lord thy God. Thou shalt have no other gods before me, nor worship a graven image. How do we put these together, and what do these have to do with the legal system? Roger Williams, the founder of Rhode Island, insisted this is part of the first table of the law, and civil government has no jurisdiction over that table of the law. Civil government has only jurisdiction over the second table. John Winthrop and the others in the New England colonies insisted otherwise, that both of these are within civil government's jurisdiction. And in a very real sense, I think they were right. What does it mean here? How is this relevant to civil government? Simply this, that God is the source of all governmental authority. That God is also the source of all limits on government. That God is the source of human rights, which are one of the bases of a limitation on government power. That we are created in His image, and being created in His image means that we possess a certain dignity and certain human rights. Okay, so putting these together then, these negative commands convey rights. Thou shalt not kill implies a right to life. Thou shalt not steal implies a right to property. These rights are meaningless unless we recognize that they come from a higher source than government. Jefferson put it this way, and these words are inscribed on the Jefferson Memorial in Washington, D.C. The God who gave us life gave us liberty. Can the liberties of a nation be secure when we have removed their only firm basis, a conviction in the minds of the people that these liberties are a gift of God and cannot be violated but with His wrath? In other words, that understanding that rights come from God is central to being able to preserve rights. Now, one of the most liberal justices in the history of the Supreme Court is William O. Douglas. And he had a lot of decisions that I would disagree with, but in a case, McGowan versus Maryland in 1961, listen to his words. They are so prescient for what they say to us today. The institutions of our society, he said, are founded on the belief that there is an authority higher than the authority of the state, that there is a moral law which the state is powerless to alter, that the individual possesses rights conferred by the Creator, which government must respect. That's the role of the Ten Commandments. The Ten Commandments, as the moral foundation for law, show respect for the basic principles of American law. Respect for life. Respect for property. Respect for family. Respect for truth. And respect for God. There was a congressman, and earlier a state senator, he was elected to Congress later, Tom McClintock, in California, and I love the way he put it. He said, there is a reason behind the movement to strike the words under God from the Pledge of Allegiance and from our national customs and our currency and our public ceremonies. It has very little to do with atheism. It has a great deal to do with authoritarianism. The radical left abhor the words under God because these words stand in the way of an all-powerful state. The French and American revolutions were waged on precisely the same declared rights of life, liberty, and equality. One was a ghastly failure that ended in the Reign of Terror, the other a magnificent success. Why? In the philosophy of the French Revolution, the rights of man were defined by a governmental committee and extended at the sufferance of that government. In the American view, these rights come from God. Their existence is preeminent, and their preservation is the principal object of government. If the source of our fundamental rights is not God, then the source becomes man, or more precisely, a government of men. And rights that can be extended by government may also be withdrawn by government. Words matter. Ideas matter. And symbols matter. The public furor fomented by the Ninth Circuit Court over the Pledge of Allegiance must not be devalued as a mere defense of harmless references and quaint old customs. The principle at stake is central to the very foundation of the American system and the very survival of its freedom.